All right, episode 3 of season 2. This is AP and Spence. We're two lawyers talking college sports. How are you doing today, AP?
I'm doing really good, although I feel like around Oregon, it's not been as good. We're sitting here in Portland and looking out. It's pretty smoky out there.
Yeah, it looks like a really dense fog is just in the whole state, right? Yeah. Over the whole western part of the state.
Yeah, and I'm a guy, I love a good campfire, but this feels like campfire all day, every day, over everybody.
Yeah, and you're not roasting any s'mores in this area.
I'm not having any s'mores. I'm not camping. I don't like it right now. And I know a lot of people are hurting. We've been evacuated, sort of evacuated. Basically, we're in level 2 where our house is, but right on the border of level 3, and it was really ashy, and we have little kids, and we thought, this isn't good, and we're on red alert here to maybe leave soon. Let's go ahead and go to Salem.
Yeah.
So we're crashing with family right now, making do. And I know there's a lot of people hurting in Oregon, so we wish everybody safety and the best out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully everybody's able to just stay inside. I mean, that's the biggest thing. It's just like the smoke is so bad. It just smells awful, and it's, you know, it's getting in your lungs. So just stay indoors, avoid going outside. Hopefully this passes.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're supposed to, in Oregon, get some cooler weather come Monday, a little sprinkles Monday, Tuesday. I'll bet you hopefully middle, late next week we'll be in really good shape. But we got to basically ride it out here for a little bit.
That's right. So you know what that sound means? That sound means college football is starting up this weekend. We've got some Power 5 football happening.
That was smooth. I mean, I have my Apple laptop here. It dings. But, you know, as a true professional, Spencer, which you are,
that's right,
you didn't miss a beat. And you were like, boom, let's incorporate that. That's why you're a pro, man. That's why you've been doing this for a couple seasons now.
That's right. That's right.
And, yeah, football, you know, you and I watched some football together this past weekend.
That's right.
We watched Navy, BYU, and it was just an unbelievable beatdown of Navy. I mean, BYU looked like a beast, actually.
Yeah, they look good. They look good. But you know what was really strange about that game for me? First of all, it was surprising BYU's kind of dominance in the game. But the bigger thing was it was surprising to see a game with zero fans. Now, with the coronavirus and with the, you know, the restrictions in place, each state is having to make, and basically each team is having to make its own rules and regulations about how many fans they're allowing into the stadium. So for Navy, it was, what, 12? I mean, how many? There was like 10 fans in the stands or something like that.
Yeah, I felt like I saw some military guy in all white. He looked great, and he was standing like all alone in this whole section. It just looked strange. I appreciate Navy. My dad was going, you know, part of the Navy. He's a fan of them. I appreciate BYU. You're an alum. You know, but it was a good football game. It didn't strike that same feeling inside of me of seeing a bunch of raucous crowd and fans. It just had this weird, ominous feeling to it.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, it's interesting watching as these games are happening this fall. You know, we've already had, there was supposed to be a game tonight, SMU-TCU, but that had to be postponed because TCU had too many COVID-19 positive student athletes. So the threshold, as you know, AP, is that they have to have at least 53 or 55 student athletes that are able to play in order for them to field the game. And so we don't know exactly what happened with this game, but all we know is that they had to postpone it. And there have been a couple other games that have been postponed: Louisiana Tech, Baylor, UCF, Florida International, East Carolina, Marshall. But we have, you know, about two dozen other games going over the weekend. So, I mean, what do you think is going on in all these schools?
Yeah, this is something I was kind of afraid of, that maybe some schools would get started, they'd start having a mess of outbreak, and how much will do they have to continue, right? Football's really critical that it goes. You have to have those rapid tests, I think, that some of these schools are getting, where you can get results in 15 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever it is. If you're sitting around waiting for 2 or 3 days to get your COVID test, find out you're negative, that's really bad, because here's the problem. If you had an outbreak of 5 kids, you test everyone on the team, you don't know if everyone on the team now has it or not. You got to sit around for 2 or 3 days. It's challenging times. I think we need to have that rapid testing. But I'm telling you, I think football can go. I still think they're trying to make it go. It should go. Our society has to find a way to work through this, because there's no guarantee of a vaccine. You know, there's no guarantee of a lot of things. And so, but they have to do it safe. I mean, you know, be safe, do it the right way. Try to take care of kids the best you can. But I'm afraid that there's going to be more postponements coming up And I think that could kind of slow football down a little bit. I worry about that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, for me, it's interesting. It seems like just about every school is making its own determination how many fans they're going to have. So, you know, I guess, and it's just in line with whatever the state allows. You know, I know in Oregon, for example, if they were playing, there would be no fans in the stands. But Utah and BYU, they're allowing 6,000 fans. But just right up the road, 30 miles north of BYU or 45 miles north of BYU is Salt Lake City and University of Utah. They're not playing at all. So, you know, it's just really interesting to see what's going on.
Yeah, there's different views of what's going on. You know, let's say, Spencer, you're the athletic director of BYU. And you don't have any specific state mandate, but they said, we're going to leave it up to your call. What do you think, from what you know, just what you're hearing, what you think about the virus, what would you like to see as far as fans?
Yeah, I think you have to err on the side of caution right now. You just have to. You don't want to do something to endanger people. So you would set it up. I think you have to set up your stadium in a way that no fan, that unless they're in a family, that they are not allowed to be within, 6 feet of one another. Right. And so that would be the mandate. So you would have to just figure it out logistically about how many fans you could fit in under those guidelines. But then you're going to have problems. How do you get the student athlete or the fans into the stadium? You get them out of the stadium. So I think you start low. I agree with what BYU is doing. I think 6,000 fans in a stadium that holds over 6,000 people is a good number. You start at 10% capacity. You allow, you know, just the student athletes, families and friends, and maybe some, you know, big time boosters into the games. But you don't want to have students in there. You want to keep things, keep things as open as possible. And then you can see how that goes. And then you open it up. And maybe the next game you have 10,000 or maybe 12,000. But when BYU, I mean, you've been in that stadium. When it is rocking and rolling and every seat is full, it is a loud, boisterous stadium. And everybody's sitting right on top of each other, basically. So what do you think university should do?
Yeah, I think the same thing. I mean, I think it'd be nice to have some fans. I mean, you have an outdoor stadium that's very big and you can social distance there really well. You know, you can have people purchase a section, maybe like, hey, there's families of four, there's families of two, there's families of six, and they are all sitting 10 feet apart, masks required. There you go. You're showing up with the mask. I mean, if you can go to Target and you can go to Walmart, you can go to a grocery store, you can go to a gas station, you know, why not go to this? You know, same thing, and make that choice, you know, and maybe you have to sign a little waiver. You understand the risk and you click on it. You wear a mask, everybody social distances, show up and wear some and just support your team. Because that's really important for a lot of people to normalize their life right now. So I'm for it, but to do it, you know, safely as you can. And I think it's going to help kids. I think right now it's going to be hard to have home field advantage. I mean, yeah, a team has to travel. I get that. But then once you're playing the game, if there's like zero crowd, it's just whistles blowing, you have no home field advantage really.
Yeah. Which is going to play a huge role in some of these games. I really think, you know, imagine the BYU Navy game. Imagine how different the Navy team would have done if they would have had, you know, 30,000 or 40,000 fans going crazy for the midshipmen. You know, I mean, it would have been a totally different game. I honestly believe that.
Yeah, for sure. And it motivates the kids. It might influence the refs a little bit. If everyone goes nuts on a pushing call, the ref might think, I'm throwing that flag.
Well, BYU doesn't push and doesn't really create, other than USC, we don't cause any penalties, you know.
Well, I know one penalty BYU got is when they rushed the field after USC's win. That I'm gonna not live that down. Flag.
You won't, as you should.
No.
So, anyways, it's just something that we're gonna monitor. We're gonna continue to monitor it and make sure that we give you all the information about everything we're hearing. But as of right now, sounds like football's gonna push forward at least in these conferences, East Coast and Southeast conferences, and we'll see what happens as things go forward.
Yep, we're excited.
All right, this is AP and Spence, two lawyers talking college sports and sports laws in general. To continue with our ongoing partnership with the sportspac12.com group, which is a credentialed sports website with original content written by experienced writers and columnists. We have some more questions to talk about today from the Sports Pac-12 readers, as well as some of our listeners. So you ready? You ready to do these questions?
I'm ready to rumble, Spence.
All right. All right. So question number one comes from Kevin in our home state of Wilsonville, Oregon. He says, is the NCAA warming up to legalized sports betting? At one time, if memory serves, they banned Oregon from hosting NCAA basketball tournaments because of the state's sports action betting. Now I have read the University of Colorado has signed a deal with PointsBet to sponsor live betting. Have their rules or policies changed? So just to give you a little background, Kevin and AP, I know you know this already, but in 2018, the NCAA did change its policies where they're now allowing championships to happen in states that are allowing sports betting because the NCAA or the U.S. Supreme Court sent out or issued a decision on a case that allowed sports betting to happen in New Jersey, and that then was promulgated to all the other states. So therefore, the NCAA kind of had to, you know, because they're going to have championships in every state, they had to allow or change their policies. So I know you have some thoughts about this. What do you think, AP?
Yeah, one, I think they had to because everything just started going. I think the name, image, and likeness is going to do the same thing to the NCAA. They would probably ideally not have that happen, but when things start getting spread and the rules start coming, states are adopting it. They can't have sports in no states. So that forces their hand to do it. But here are the problem with sports gambling. That's why athletic departments want to stay away from it. Student athletes can never gamble on sports. Staff members can never gamble on sports.
That even applies to like fantasy football or fantasy basketball or anything, right?
Absolutely. Whenever you're wagering anything of value, even a dollar, that's gambling on real sports. And so now you can do those free pools. If it was a free CBS pool, you're not wagering anything. That was okay. But people would always do these little office pools. And if you do that, let's say you were working at BYU and they said, let's put around a little March Madness pool. Everyone put chip in a dollar. Winner gets the pot. Violation, that's a problem, major problem. You're betting on sports. Why? Because it's insider trading in a lot of ways. When you're an athletics department staff member, you learn about injuries, different things that are happening. You think, ooh, that's going to change the line. They're not going to announce that injury for a couple of days, but I know it now. I could bet on the other team right now, and I have that inside knowledge. That's why they don't want betting in sports. It's not a good idea. So if you work in college athletics, you're a student athlete, no betting on sports. But yes, the rules have changed, where they can still host championships in states that are sponsoring and partnering with some of those activities.
All right. That's great. Great answer as always, AP. Okay, here we go. Second question. This is from Barry in beautiful Tucson, Arizona. He asks, a lot of reporters with agendas have weighed in on Arizona's probable NCAA basketball penalty, but I haven't yet heard a sports attorney's view on it. What do you think is going to happen to the Cats?
Well, I think the Cats are in trouble. Because they have a lot of evidence on them. They're part of the underbelly of basketball problems with the FBI. They're one of the schools. And they're caught. They got in the middle of it, and they're going to be in big trouble. I think they're going to lawyer up. I think they're going to try to make deals with the NCAA, that sort of thing. But they're going to – I would expect for Arizona to have a one-year postseason ban, a show cause order for the coach and some of the other staff members. And it's going to set Arizona back for 3 or 4 years. It just is. You know, they have a lot of evidence on Arizona, from what I understand. Unless their evidence turns out to be false or their information was incorrect, I think they're just in big trouble. And I would just, if you're an Arizona Cats fan, I would expect a one-year postseason ban and to take a back. You're going to have a hit probably in recruiting as well, because you're going to lose some scholarships and you're going to have to have a tough year for 3 or 4 years and build your way back up. And I think I would just expect that if you're a fan.
That's in line with the precedent that's been set by what happened at Oklahoma State. Similar allegations, year postseason ban, some scholarship reductions, show cause order to the assistant coach who did everything. And based on what they're saying, that's going to happen at LSU, right? So level 2, level 1 violations, the coach is probably out. It's going to be tough, but we'll see what happens with Arizona, because you have allegations against Arizona and Kansas that are very similar, and those are two of the NCAA's flagship programs. So what I'm really curious to see is, okay, they've dinged Oklahoma State pretty good. They're probably going to ding LSU pretty good as well, But those are two of the kind of mid-level programs in the NCAA. They're in Power Five conferences, but mid-level, they don't have the same history that an Arizona or a Kansas has. So do you think that the NCAA is going to treat Arizona and Kansas differently than they're going to than they treated Arizona, Oklahoma State, and that they may treat LSU?
Yeah, you know, there's often a misconception about this. I've heard in the dark shadows from people that work at the NCAA that they would actually like to impact a marquee name sport because it sets kind of an example of like, I'm going to get all you smaller troops in line by taking out the king. There's this misconception, I think, that the NCAA is making off money off brands of schools specifically, but they really don't, because there's going to be, well, if Arizona and North Carolina are any good, other schools will be good, and it doesn't really matter to us because the money comes from student fees and TV money, and it's really not relevant to us which programs are good or bad. What happens, though, is that more marquee programs have better legal resources. And so the better attorneys are hired on and they have better results. And then it appears at the end, see, the NCAA gave some deals to the better schools because they're trying to protect them. But that's really not it. It's those schools have better representation because they have more resources. That's why it's so important to be able to have those attorneys that can protect you in these kind of situations.
Gotcha. All right. Question three. Some people are suggesting that the NCAA dragged its feet in pushing for a football season as much to squelch the players' groups' demands as to protect them from COVID-19. Given its nonprofit status and commitment to amateurism, do you think the NCAA could be colluding with the conferences to stop the NIL, meaning name, image, and likeness, movement? If so, what legal remedies would players have if this proved to be the case? So I guess the first question is, you know, do you think that, you know, obviously these players coming out with these demands, asking for a portion of the revenue, better information about testing, that kind of stuff. Do you think that played a role in some of these schools and conferences canceling their seasons or postponing their seasons? Because that seems like that's the first question. And then the next question is, do you think that there was collusion here between the NCAA and these conferences?
I don't like the word collusion. I don't think anything kind of nefarious where there was dark shadows of people deciding how to mess people over or anything like that. I do know I don't think that the conferences loved the idea that players were banding together demanding things. And that might have hastened what the Pac-12 decided, let's just get out of this. Because the truth is, if all college athletes just got together and said, we're unionizing and we expect 1, 2, and 3, or we aren't playing, there's no product. And so there's a limited talent pool there. They probably would get some of the demands they want. You're not going to get revenue sharing. You're not going to turn yourself into employee, but there's demands you could probably have come through that would be headaches to conferences and schools. That's true for a lot of different professions. I mean, gosh, I mean, if every lawyer got together and said, we demand A, B, and C from the bar, or we aren't doing it, bar's probably gonna have to go, oh, yikes, let's figure this out, because who else are we gonna get to go do, you know, same idea. So I think that hastened a little bit. I think that was becoming a problem. I don't think Larry Scott liked that the players were doing those demands. I think he was kind of like pushing it to the side a little bit, didn't want to really hear it. But I don't think there's any collusion. Look, the NCAA wants name, image, and likeness. They know that some of the rules are coming. They know that the rules are changing. The laws are changing. They want to be a part of it. You and I, Spence, have been at the NCAA headquarters.
Right.
In Indianapolis, talking to people firsthand, they know it's coming.
Great people at the NCAA. I feel like there's this stigma that the NCAA people there are these, like, everyone walking around in these multi-thousand-dollar suits, and they're good people. They seem to me to be honest, hardworking, wanting to enforce the rules. Good people, all had smiles on their faces. It was not this like nefarious, like, you know, oligarchy that was there that was existing. Was my impression.
Yeah, I think the NCAA has a PR problem sometimes for some reason, but a lot of them are just regular folks that are making between $50,000 and $150,000 a year. They got a salary, they got benefits, they're wearing a collared shirt and khakis to work, living down the street, trying to take care of their family. They like sports. This was a cool job to get. And they're doing the best they can to manage whatever small niche they have at the NCAA. And that's it. And the people say, well, the NCAA is making so much money. Well, so does McDonald's. McDonald's makes billions of dollars, but not all the worker bees are making all that money. So kind of the same idea. And a lot of that money goes into sponsor events and to sponsor schools and to do scholarships. It's not like they're they're just all getting rich and they're showing up in Bugattis to work and stuff. There's always that kind of misconception. And yes, there's a few millionaires at the NCAA and a few elite head people, like a CEO and a VP might be. But the average Joe there is just a regular folks that we know that are working hard, doing the best they can. They know a name, image, and likeness is coming, but what they know is that there's going to be a lot of compliance problems with it. There's the iceberg has a lot on the bottom. It's not just about pay these kids. Everybody wants the kids to get paid, and they know they deserve it, but you've got to be able to protect the collegiate model. Otherwise, it just becomes the minor leagues, and then their employees, there's workers' compensation problems. It could turn into a full mess.
Right.
So you got to be careful of that, and so they know that.
Yeah, so I guess the question then, you could pose a hypothetical saying, if there is collusion, if there was collusion between the NCAA and these conferences, and it was done to hurt the student athletes, what remedy would the student athletes have? I mean, really, they could probably file some type of a lawsuit against the school and the NCAA. They could do that, but that's a pretty far-fetched lawsuit, because there'd be a lot that you'd have to prove to actually show that there was collusion.
You probably need to start with some sort of whistleblower or something, right? I mean,
exactly.
It'd be really tough.
You'd have to have evidence. I mean, you couldn't just do it on you know what and conjecture and just thinking, well, there must have been collusion. Mm-hmm. You'd have to actually show that there was collusion. And then there'd be depositions, and there'd be evidence that would be submitted. And if all these conferences, as of right now, are all saying, "Hey, we canceled the season specifically for COVID," and maybe that's a lucky break that they had or whatever. But still, if that's what they're going to say in a deposition, is our doctor said we got to cancel, we canceled. Did it have anything? Then the next question: did it have anything to do with these student demands? No. We canceled because of the coronavirus, and that's what they've said publicly. I haven't heard anybody say publicly or any evidence saying we were scared about what these student athletes were trying to do and grouping together.
Yeah, I think you'd have to find some sort of internal email that came out, whistleblower, that's like, look at all these emails going back and forth talking about how can we shut down the name, image, and likeness. Here's what we're going to do. Let's work with the conference. You know, it'd have to be like that smoking gun. And then you could bring a lawsuit and say maybe there's tortious interference of, you know, different things. But that's a tough one. And overall, I do agree the more concerning thing to them was the player demands. Name, image, and likeness, the NCAA, I don't think is that worried about it. They're going to make some rules on it, but they're going to riddle it with holes and put a lot of emphasis on compliance. Compliance officers are going to beef up. They're not going to shrink. They're going to beef up in the next year or two. You're going to see staffs get 8, 9, 10, 11 people.
Yeah, they're going to have to.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to have a lot of money spent there. And if you got to pay your head coach instead of $5 million, you pay him $3 million and you put a couple million bucks in compliance, you're going to have to start doing that. And that's what you're going to see.
All right. So here's the next question, and this is a good question, I think. So we've got a question from Sandra in Denver, Colorado. She asks, "Are women really getting pushed out of competitive college sports because of transgender athletes? How much of this is real versus paranoia, and have there been any significant challenges to the laws or policies that allow transgender athletes to compete with women?"
Yeah, I mean. The basic thing is the NCAA has some policies on this, and the gist is, you know, if you're a female, a biological female, and you've decided you're going to identify as a male, you have to be diagnosed with I think a gender identity disorder.
Yep. Gender dysphoria.
The gender dysphoria, and if you've been diagnosed by a medical doctor, a therapist, a licensed therapist, something like that, it's in your medical record, and you're seeking treatment. I think if you're trying to become a male, you're increasing your testosterone.
That's right.
Female, you're having testosterone suppression sort of ideas. I don't know all the medical specifics of it, but that's the gist of it. And you have to have a medical doctor, you have to have medical treatment going on in your record. You have to prove it to the NCAA. This isn't somebody that just one day wakes up and goes, "I'm going to compete for the women's team or the men's team." No, this is a paper trail for a period of time that you can prove to the NCAA, "I truly identify as this gender, and this is the diagnosis I have, and here are the medical treatments I've done, and here's all the proof to you." If you can do all that and show it to the NCAA, they'll say, "Fine, you can now compete with the men or you compete with the women," but it's permanent. You can't go back and forth. You couldn't do it for a season,
right,
and now I'm going to switch back. That's the general policy with the NCAA. And there have been a few athletes out there that have done this.
Right. But it's not something that where women are being pushed out by, you know, tons and tons of transgender athletes who are born male and now identify as female. There isn't that huge push of that. There are a couple. There have been a couple of cross country athletes who were male and now competing against females. So it's not something that is pushing women out of the women's sports. It'll be interesting to see as if that grows, right? If that changes. Right now, it's they're isolated. There aren't very many. But if that grows, if that changes, it'll be interesting to see what the NCAA and what student athletes, how they respond.
Yeah, and I think here's the thing. I mean, not only does somebody have to be diagnosed with it by a medical authority, prove it up in medical records, going through the medical treatment, not just planning on it, but actually going through the medical treatment. If you're going to do all of that and identify as the other, I don't think you're going to do that just for athletic reasons, obviously, right? You're somebody that's identifying that way. Now, look, can I articulate the argument that somebody might have? Sure. I mean, is it going to be one of those situations where somebody's going to say, hey, this male now comes to all the women's sports and they're athletically superior in some way, and I'm mad about that. There might be somebody that argues that, right? But I haven't personally seen a huge pushing out or problem with it yet. It could come in the future. We don't know. I think things can change in the future with our societies if we become more inclusive and that sort of thing. And so it's something I think to monitor and keep our eyes on. But unless you've seen it, Spencer, I really haven't seen any kind of issues with that just yet.
No, I mean, and this is something you brought up earlier as we were chatting about these questions. The NCAA is all about inclusion, right? They are all about inclusion. They are very much an organization that is inclusive of everyone. As long as you are at that level and you're willing to go through what you need to go through to play that sport, whether you are male or female, identify as male or female, they're going to work their hardest, the NCAA, to work their hardest to get that individual to play their sport that they love. And that's what it comes down to. And so, it'll be interesting to see as this progresses, what changes, if it gets to be a bigger deal or if it gets to be continued to be kind of just this minor issue, not really even an issue, but just kind of minor thing that happens. But we'll continue to monitor it, but that's a great, great question. All right. Last question. Robert from Hayward, California asks, as athletes return to practice and competition and universities try to protect high-risk individuals, such as older coaches and administrators, do they also expose themselves to possible age discrimination lawsuits?
Yeah, this is a tricky one. I mean, obviously, I think COVID-19, statistically speaking, attacks people that are either have comorbidities or are older. Especially people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, I think they're extremely high risk if they have comorbidities of having serious complications if they get COVID-19. So, but I don't know, Spencer. My thought is, I think you agree with this, is that nobody has to work, right?
That's exactly right.
I mean, you want to go to work, but if you're 72 and you have high blood pressure and you're overweight and a lot of comorbidities and you think, gosh, I don't feel safe doing this, then don't do it. I mean, right? I mean, in the end, say, you know what? I'm retiring. I'm moving on, or doing a different type of job. I don't want that to sound cold. I'm just saying that you don't have to do it. Now, if somebody doesn't have you out there for a reason, I personally don't see it. It would be discrimination per se.
Yeah, I don't think so either, because I think that you would have to prove that the individual was forced to work. And that the individual received or acquired the coronavirus from their work exposure at the school. And if that's the case, the reality is probably your best option is to file some type of a workers' compensation claim, because these coaches are employees. And they probably would have to sign some type of a waiver, I would think, in order for them to continue working. But the reality is that it's going to be hard to prove that the individual acquired coronavirus or COVID-19 specifically and only from their work exposure. I mean, assuming that this person drives to work, goes to the grocery store, is going to out to eat at restaurants, is going to family events and weddings and that kind of thing, there it would be really hard to prove. I know I got coronavirus from going to work every day, right?
Yeah, especially because it has an incubation period between 2 and 14 days, I've heard. So, gosh, I mean, yeah, maybe you had a little outbreak at your work, but maybe 7 days before you were a small little barbecue and then somebody had it there too. Not everybody's being contact traced. And I just think it's one of those real long shots. And really, I think the takeaway is if you're concerned and you're elderly or you have a lot of comorbidities, put yourself in a safe spot, you know, and don't put yourself in a harm's way.
You know, I just had the thought that if the school said to someone who is over 70, we don't want you coming here because you have these comorbidities, and we know that coronavirus can affect you negatively, and we don't want any type of an issue to come to you. That, I guess, in theory, could be age discrimination if they did that, if they said that. But more than likely, schools aren't going to say that to an individual.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that if they were specifically targeting anybody over 40, because that's the ADEA standard, is you got to, if you're over 40, you're in the older category. So both you and I are now
elderly.
We could sue for age discrimination. but if a school is targeting someone because of their age,
yeah,
and telling them to stay away because of their age, then you probably could have an age discrimination lawsuit. But you know, but then you have these, you probably have some type of force majeure, some type of contract issue. Anyways, it's just kind of an interesting thought to kind of play out a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So possible, but tricky, and good question though. Fun to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Those are the five questions that we got from the Pac-12, sportspac12.com writers and listeners and readers. We'd invite you guys, everybody, to go and go to the sportspac12.com website, read their blogs, their articles. They're exceptionally written. They have a little thing about us, so that's kind of nice.
Well, but yeah, if no other reason, I'm sure they're an excellent organization. Check us out.
That's right. That's right. All right. All right. What does that sound mean, AP?
We're going to the phones.
That's right. We're going to the phones. And this going to the phones is brought to us by Welch, Bruin, and Green. We're a law firm based in Portland, Oregon. We specialize in workers' compensation, personal injury, social security disability, and what else, AP?
Collegiate sports law. We can do anything a compliance office could do, plus more. We can review coaches' contracts. We can help with an investigation. We can help you draft or rewrite policies and procedures that you have for your athletic department or compliance office. We can audit for you. Give us a call. We'll help you out.
Absolutely. What's the best way to get in contact with us?
I think phone is great, Spencer.
Me
503-221-0870. Ask for Aaron or Spencer.
You can also go to our website, which is wbgatty.com. You could email us directly at our Gmail account, which is collegesportsattorneys@gmail.com. Or you can email me at skelly@wbgatty.com, or what else?
aprice@wbgatty.com.
Give us a call. You won't regret it. All right, here we are going to the phones. AP, who do we have on the phones today?
So we have a good friend of mine, Justin Polnow. He is the director of compliance at Arizona State University. They're in Tempe, Arizona. The Sun Devils, as I know you know, Spencer.
I absolutely knew that.
And I had the opportunity to work with Justin when I was at USC. We would collaborate on different things. I was working with football at USC, and one of the sports he works with is football at Arizona State. And we would just, you know, collaborate on things and hey, how are you guys doing this? Or what are you guys doing there? How do you approach this or that issue? Hey, what about this camp issue, this and that? And I found it, for me, it was really helpful to have another person or two in the conference that I could sort of go to and text and ask questions of, and vice versa, just to know we're all kind of on the same page. And approaching things the same way, because some of the answers can be a little bit of a gray area, you know, or you can approach one issue two different ways. And so I know for me, I always found Justin to be just really detailed, really knew the rules, very proactive. I always found him to know what's coming down the pipe and how things are approached. And so I really respected him a lot. And I've been fortunate to track him down, and he's going to join us on our podcast today.
Awesome. Hey there, Justin. How you doing?
Good. How are you guys? Good. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, hey, Justin, we always like to start with our guests. Just kind of, if you could kind of give us a, you know, brief rundown of your background and kind of what your current position is, where you're at.
Yeah, of course. So I'm originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I've been here in Arizona for going on my 9th year. So 9 years at Arizona State, started in 2012. Before Arizona State, I was at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay for 3 years, so I got a little experience at small school, and I got my first job out of law school at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. That's kind of how I got my start. I traveled from Wisconsin down to the Gulf Coast and worked there, and had a great experience for that first year, and got me back to Green Bay, and then I wanted to try the big time college athletics out, and Arizona State is where I've been for 8 years. So I went to law school at Marquette. So I'm part of there might be some Marquette Mafia people listening out there. So shout out to Marquette Mafia. But when I was at Marquette, I had an internship at Northern Illinois my 3L year. And that's how I found out how I wanted to do compliance.
That's great. That's a great. Now, of course, Aaron knows the mascot for Wisconsin Green Bay, of course, right?
Packers, baby.
No, they're the Phoenix, man. They're the Phoenix. Come on.
Okay, I just hear Green Bay, and I think Aaron Rodgers, and I'm thinking, but no, that's cool. That's good. I can respect that. You know, Justin, it's fun. Marquette, first of all, is a fantastic school. I know Jill Ingalls, I think, went to Marquette Law School. She was at USC for a while, and then in compliance, and then now she's at the Milwaukee Bucks. Went back home to Wisconsin, but why don't you share with the listeners kind of what's it like in the day in the life and compliance? Are you working with football there? And if so, what are some of the things you kind of do for the athletic department there?
Yeah. So, well, the last 6 months, just like pretty much everybody else in this world, everything's thrown a curveball to us. So the day in the life is a little bit different now than what it was 6 months ago. So for me particularly, I oversee the question and the insert intake for our office, kind of manage that, do the research, the high level questions. Now anybody in our office can take the question in, and depending on the length and how much depth we need to go into it, they'll usually work, and we'll work amongst our staff to try to figure out the proper answer. I also manage our rules education program. So education is, besides monitoring, is one of the most important parts when it comes to compliance. So we help oversee the rules education, and I also dabble in financial aid. I got my start at Arizona State doing financial aid, and then my experience at a small school doing everything in compliance helped me branch out once I got to Arizona State to be able to do more when I got there.
Yeah, and Justin, and you said that you've been at Arizona State for about 9 years, and you guys hired a brand new football coach here a couple of years ago, who's kind of coming from the NFL. Had Coach Edwards had any college experience in the past, and did you have any problems with kind of instructing him about the NCAA rules and recruiting and that kind of that stuff as he got started at Arizona State?
Coach Edwards, he's been great to work with. What you see is what you get with Coach Edwards. It's been a great experience. And I do work closely with football. I forgot to mention that before. That's probably the sport that I spend most of my time with. And so Coach Edwards didn't really have much more experience with college athletics, except for maybe a stint back in like the 80s. He had somewhere in California, I think, work. But coming in, I think it was a little bit of a shock for him to realize how many rules there actually are. And some of the nuances to them. So to really tailor the education to Herm Edwards, and not just only Herm Edwards, but other people on the staff. Marvin Lewis is now a part of the staff, so getting to know Marvin Lewis, Kevin Y, Hall of Fame center, getting to know him, and Antonio Pierce is another one. He's a linebacker with the Giants. He's kind of leading the recruiting effort. So it's been a great experience getting to know them, get to learn them, and try to challenging also because there's some pretty big high profile names there that I just mentioned.
Yeah, Justin, I was wondering. I know when I was at USC and I'd have a coach that really hadn't spent a whole lot of time in college, so it was kind of green to some of the nuances of the rules. What I would try to do, and everybody approaches this a little different, but I would try to spend a little extra time with them, put together maybe some mini rules ed sessions on some things. Do you have a certain approach when you approach a coach that's maybe not just Herm Edwards, but just another coach that just has been pretty green with the rules, is kind of new to college coaching, or do you kind of approach them the same as just anyone else?
That's a really good question. So any new hire in our department, in Sun Devil Athletics, we meet with them. Somebody in our office will meet with them to go through an onboarding education, kind of a one-on-one sit down, get to know us, let us tell them about the history at Arizona State. I know you guys had Brad Chandler on back in January, and he kind of mentioned that we were number two in the country in major infraction cases. So a lot of times coaches will come from other schools where we like to say we're a little bit, and Aaron, you may be able to speak to this at USC, we're just involved a little bit more because we have to be involved, because our president wants us to be involved, so there's no more major infraction cases.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I know when I was at USC, sometimes a coach would come from a different, maybe smaller school back east or something, and I would be around a lot. I'd be in their office. I'm popping in. We have little rules ed once a week, and they might. And I've had comments a couple times of like, "Geez, you guys are always around. What's going on?" You know, almost like at first, is there a problem? You know, and it was no, not at all. You know, this is just kind of our culture of compliance. We have to be around. The president wants it. The athletic director wants it. This is what we're about. And we're going to have to just walk hand in hand. And I'm sure a lot of that is the same at Arizona State.
Yes, correct. And going back to the previous question, too, we have met with some new staff members with football on multiple occasions just to go through, we call it supplemental education, give them a little bit more. And then to your point, too, I do like to get out of the office and just go say hi to people and just walk around and get to know them as a person. Because I think when you can interact with them, not always talking about the NCAA rules, but just, hey, get to know them as an individual. It makes your relationship and the comfort level for them to come ask you questions all that much greater.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, Spencer and I have talked about that. Having a relationship is key, I think, in compliance to being successful at it. They have to trust you. They want to be friends with you. You know, if they feel like you're trying to get them in trouble all the time, or if you're poking around a practice and they're antennas go up, that's not good. You want them to feel like, yeah, you're just part of the team. You're here as a security blanket to help me and educate me, keep me on the right path, not a cop that's trying to trick me into something and have, you know, getting me in trouble. And that's hard. It's hard to have that, you know. And you know, anyway, so you mentioned things are changing a little bit, you know, with this COVID-19. And how has that changed kind of some of the rules, some of the ways you, Arizona State does things? I mean, are you working in the office? Are you remote? I mean, how have things changed since COVID-19 for you in your office?
Yeah, so we started going back into the office staggered probably within the last month. So we each go in a couple days a week right now, different. And then the other days of the week, we are still working remotely. So that's where we're at in the office right now. The last 6 months have been fascinating and frustrating at the same time. Fascinating in a sense of seeing how these rules are quickly changing and adapting, and then frustrating in a sense of they didn't go quite the way or change quite the way you wanted them to or expected them to. And it kind of gives you a little bit of handcuff. I'm like, let's just go a little bit further with this to make everybody's lives a little bit easier right now.
So has there, you know, is the football team practicing right now, or are they, you know, or are they just, is everything put on hold right now?
For us, we are in what we call the 12-hour week right now. Sometimes I get mixed up with where the rules are at, but I'm pretty sure it's 12 hours right now. They can have 5 hours, quote-unquote, on the field and 7 hours off the field. So, yes, they are, but we're limited with the type of contact that you can have. So it's just basically walkthroughs right now, and then we're waiting information coming out next week from the D1 council on kind of where to go from here for fall practice.
Gotcha. Has there been a lot of communication, to your knowledge, between the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, being that they're the two Power Five conferences that are not moving forward with football right now? And if so, then what kind of communication is going on?
Yeah, I believe there is communication. Right? They're the two conferences right now that everybody's talking about not playing. And so I think even Larry Scott has mentioned that, trying to be kind of see where they go and see what we do and go from there. If we can be in lockstep with the season, great. If we can't, then so be it. So, and I know an issue for us in the Pac-12, and Larry Scott has talked about this, is just some of the locales, specifically the California schools, and then up by you guys in Oregon, they're just limited from a municipality standpoint where they can't practice and have contact. So to target a season right now is just not feasible under the laws of their land. So
yeah, I was wondering about, I mean, gosh, that's got to be tough for not only the coaches and but the student athletes too, where like Arizona State football is not going. They're not playing games, but yet you have all these other schools, SEC schools, ACC schools, Big 12. They're playing. They're on TV on the weekends. That's got to be kind of strange, I would imagine, or frustrating maybe for the players and the coaches. You know, but it's just the way it shakes out. We have a big country, and there's just different views on different things. But, you know, has there been any – I know there's been like a little scuttlebutt out there about potentially a delayed season start or even a spring season. Any thoughts on how that might work?
Yeah, I think Larry Scott was on the Rich Eisen show a couple of days ago, and he talked to us a day before that, I think, because we have a weekly Pac-12 football call meeting just to see where we're at, what's going on. And I know he mentioned on the Rich Eisen show that it Quidel, I think I pronounced it right, is the testing aspect. It could be a game changer in the fact that I know the big concern, and he's mentioned this, is the heart issues and what exactly goes on in the heart if you get COVID, and that's kind of the scary part. And ultimately, I think what stopped everything in the Big Ten and the Pac-12 area.
Yeah, I heard a little bit about that. Yeah, some like enlarging of the heart or some kind of strange heart thing somehow, that weird stuff that I don't understand but doesn't sound good, and you don't want to expose anybody to it. Do you think it's even – I mean, if there was a spring schedule, do you think that the kids that are – I mean, how would that work for kids that are planning on graduating in the fall? Or would they just be automatically granted an extra year of eligibility? Do you think anybody would stay around for that?
I guess it's going to be case-by-case decision. I know every day you see a new copy elite student-athlete who decides, I'm just going to forego being at school and focus on the NFL draft. And so you have those guys who, no qualms whatsoever, just go out and do your thing and try to get yourself prepared. And then you have the individuals who are never going to play professional sports, and those are going to be the ones that will stick around. And if there's a spring season, then try to play in the spring season and come back and get another year after that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just crazy. I mean, you think basketball will be impacted at all?
It's interesting, right? Because you can see on the professional level, right? You can do the bubble. The bubble works at the professional level, but there's so many colleges. It's hard, and we'll see what the basketball oversight committees come up with in respect to starting a season and seeing if all conferences can get going. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, it's a tough time right now. What's your office look like there at Arizona State? How many folks you got, and how's it broke down?
Repeat that.
Oh, I was curious how many staff members you got there in your compliance office right now at Arizona State, and kind of how everything sort of broke down. Is it by bylaw or by sport or area?
Yeah, so we have 8 full-time staff members in our office. We have one staff member fully dedicated to financial aid. And then we're not broken up specifically by bylaws or by sport. It's kind of a hybrid. You kind of gravitate towards the sport. I know Brad Chandler, who you had on the show, works with men's basketball for us, and I take on football for us. And then after that, it's kind of we see who we hire and what their strengths are and kind of navigate in that area for them. But ultimately, we want to get people well-rounded, so if they move on and go towards another job, that they have the experience to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to set up the office. I mean, I've always thought that a lot of organizations just find out what people's strengths are, what they're good at, what they like doing, put them in that area if you can, and you're going to maximize everybody's abilities and get a good office going. It's crazy times, man. I mean, are there some new rules coming down the pipe that you're hearing about right now?
I mean, there's new rules. I didn't even get a chance. There's more rules that came out today. The we call it the COVID Q&A is out right now, and every, it's probably 80 pages right now, and it started off probably 35 pages, it's up to 80, maybe 85. It's just fascinating to see what we have to deal with next. And the recruiting part is the interesting one. Everybody has a feeling, and I think it's out there, that the dead period is going to keep getting extended. How can you bring recruits on campus if schools are struggling to get their own student athletes going. So recruiting's been interesting to see where we go and the lack of being able to bring them on campus and coaches going out to see them.
Yeah, that's got to be really tough. I mean, gosh, and I think that would disadvantage schools for sure that aren't in major metro areas where, you know, like I'm sure there's kids that live in the LA area. They've been to USC's campus a bunch. They're taking unofficial visits there a bunch, and maybe it's not as big of a deal. But yeah, official visits and really unofficial visits in the true sense where they're with a coach, not just walking around on their own. Yeah, you can't do that. And so how are you guys doing? Is it just all virtual right now, Zoom calls and virtual tours, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure all coaches have been on multiple Zoom calls. Everybody's getting good at Zoom. I'm sure you guys know Zoom calls and stuff. But yeah, it's virtual calls and establishing relationships and phone calls and text messages and trying to get creative with how you can show your campus though. Whether it's HD videos and just showing people, we have a beautiful campus at Arizona State and beautiful facilities, and for our coaches to be able to show those off to recruits even though they can't see them, it's something I know that we are constantly working at and trying to gear towards.
Yeah. Has it changed your guys' operation at all with this layoff, the layoffs? They're not really layoffs. They're furloughs for a temporary period of time for some NCAA folks. Does that delay some of, like, reporting violations? Maybe they just sit in a queue or that sort of thing? Oh, sorry about that. Yeah. I was curious about if it impacted your business at all having furloughs at the NCAA. You know, I know some of those staff members for 6 weeks. I mean, does that affect you guys reaching out for some interps or reporting violations or getting a waiver or anything like that?
Not yet, because I know I reached out to a couple NCAA staff members that I know and just checked in and see how everybody's doing. Because it's important to have a really good relationship with the NCAA and the NCAA staff members. And I don't know if the furloughs have actually gone in place yet. So we haven't seen any stoppage in that area, but I think over the next 3 to 4 months is when we may see some stoppage. But I have confidence in the NCAA being able to handle the transition in particular groups not being all out at the same time. So I know they'll do a great job of managing through that. Unfortunate, but I think they'll do a great job.
Hey, Justin, we want to thank you so much for your insights. They've been really interesting. This is such a strange time in everybody's lives, let alone, and especially with college sports. And just as kind of we're wrapping up here, if you were to give advice to someone who's wanting to maybe get into the compliance world or get into the college sports world and work in that world, in that field, what type of advice would you give that person?
Yeah, great question. So I meet with students probably a couple times a semester, and so we talk through it, and I just like to say it straight up. You need to have experience these days. You need to figure out some sort of volunteer or some sort of internship. We have a program with our law school and with our sports law and business program of bringing the students in and helping us out and get them experience that way. Networking. I never realized how important networking was until I was able to change from Texas A&M Corpus Christi up to Green Bay. And so it's just reaching out to people, but be prepared. Be prepared to ask them questions. Don't just reach out and expect them to give you a job or hand you something on a silver platter. You gotta put in the time, put in the work. And then my other piece of advice is, entry-level positions don't pay a lot in this industry, so you need to be prepared that you're not going to make a lot of money. Now, if you stick with it, you get there, you'll start to make decent money, decent livelihood. But I know we've had a couple issues with people expecting way more money than what it was for a coordinator position, and we're like, there's just limited amount of money that can go around in college athletics.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I think compliance has gotten more competitive over the years. I mean, I think way back when, if you were a coordinator, you could get by with just, hey, I love sports and I'm a hard worker, you know, and they would throw you into something, you know, and then as the years went by, coordinators now could need 2 or 3 years of experience just to know the basics and the rules and nuances to monitor things correctly. And it's not out of the question for directors to have, you know, 7, 8, 10, 12 years experience. And it's just more and more competitive. People went to law school or got an MBA or master's in something. And but it's a great profession, you know. And I don't think the layoffs have really hit compliance as much. Have you heard any of that, Justin, at all?
I hope not, because we have this name, image, likeness beast coming in the next year, and it's not, from the sounds of it, it sounds like compliance is going to be cast with a decent amount of that. So I hope schools don't let compliance people go. And every school is different. If a school respects compliance, they'll obviously keep compliance around. If they don't, then you might see some cuts in compliance. So it'll be interesting to see. And I know all my colleagues out there, I wish everybody the best. I hope things don't hit them hard in this time period. But when you're talking to losing $50 to $60 to $70 million in your athletic department, there's going to be a lot of people hurting.
Yeah, it's just such a tough time right now. Hopefully that they can figure out this COVID-19 stuff, get things going again, get March Madness going, get football going, and get some money kind of coming back in, get things back on track. It'll take a little while, but I think they'll get there. And I guess on a parting thought before we let you go on this Friday, and appreciate your time, you touched on the name, image, and likeness. What do you see, would you say, is the biggest challenge if that gets going as far as from a compliance perspective?
I think that's going to be it within the next year. It's going to be name, image, likeness. But it's just challenging times with COVID right now, and trying to navigate and work through the constant changes, making sure you check in with your coaches if you're working from home, maintain those relationships with everybody that you can, even though everybody's separated right now. So this COVID thing is challenging, and the name, image, likeness thing, great. It's going to be a great thing for the student athletes, but it's going to be a challenging one to figure out how to navigate through it.
Yeah, I know. I've been predicting that for a while. I think it's going to be really cool. I think everybody's going to figure it out, but it's just going to be really hard. There's going to be some pitfalls, some changes, some nuances, some loops that are added in, and then eventually they'll get it right, but it'll just take some time. But well, Justin, first of all, thank you so much for joining our podcast. Your insight was great. We love hearing from somebody that has a lot of compliance experience like you, has worked at a lot of cool schools, has a great background, Arizona State, and hopefully football gets going here, whether it's a delay or it's in step with Big Ten or the spring or something. And we'll be rooting for the Sun Devils for sure. And hopefully we can stay in touch, man.
Cool. Thank you guys so much for having me, and keep up the great work. Your podcast is awesome.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate it, man.
Bye, Justin.
Have a good weekend. See ya.
All right. Take care. All right. Bye.
All right. This is AP and Spence coming back after a great phone call. Great insights, great thoughts. Really interesting to hear how Arizona State is handling the coronavirus with football. And he really knows his stuff, obviously.
Yeah, Justin's been in compliance for years and years. And he's been at Arizona State itself for 9 years. So he's got tons of compliance experience, but you heard him a couple times. I think we're in the 12 hours right now. You know, everything changes so much in compliance. Even if you have a lot of years of experience, things are on the fly. So it requires a proactive personality that's going to track down that new change, that new this, new that. Because otherwise you're going to be quoting to a coach the wrong rule, last week's rule. It's very easy to do that in compliance. And so you got to really be on your toes at all times. Things change all the time. Not easy to do. It's a hard job. Thankless job a lot of times, because coaches will just pop in. What about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? And you got to just bang, bang, bang. And they never want to know, like, could you get back to me in a couple weeks? It's always, can you get back to me in 10 minutes? Like, text me. I'm going to go around the corner. And it's like, holy smoke. Okay, let me. And so a lot of a compliance officer's job is like a fireman, where you'll have periods where there's not a ton of like work product to do, but you're available for those immediate rapid fire questions. And it can be slow for an hour, and then it's bang, 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 you know. And that's just kind of how it is. But Justin does a great job. And he gave us some insight of, you know, gosh, is football going to be in the fall or is it going to be in the spring? It's hard to say. But they're going to try to maybe work in tandem with the Big Ten. And these rapid testing kits are really, really important. And if you want to work in compliance, networking is key. And you're going to get paid low. You get compliance officers. It's not out of the question. You're going to get $30,000 to $40,000 a year. That's just what it is. And you got to get a couple years experience. And then maybe if you're an assistant director mid-level, I mean, who knows? You'll get $50,000 to $80,000 a year. And, you know, and then if you get into the director heads of compliance, you get those six-figure jobs. But it's going to take you a lot of years. They don't want to give those jobs to someone that has 2 or 3 years, because when the head coach comes running in from BYU and goes, I need to know right now, you have to have the right answer. Because if you give the wrong answer, you messed over the whole football team, and that's going to be on ESPN.
Yeah, you're going to be in big trouble. So, yeah, interesting. You know, it's fun. It was fun to talk to him and then hearing a little bit about his background. You know, he was at three schools, he said, before Arizona State. Northern Illinois, the
Fighting – no, it's not the Fighting. It's the – Northern Illinois, because I think Illinois, I think Illini, right? Immediately you want to, but Northern Illinois, it's going to be like, it's, I can see that animal in my, and it's red and white and black. Bearcats.
Yeah, no, they're the Huskies, Northern Illinois Huskies. I know you knew that.
Yeah.
And then he was at Texas A&M Corpus Christi, one of my favorite schools, which is, they are the
Camels.
Islanders. And then the last one was Wisconsin Green Bay. We talked about that one already. They are the
Not the Packers, because we went over that. It's the
We just said it too. It's a major city in Arizona. How about that?
Oh, Phoenix.
The Phoenix. One of my favorites. Doesn't end in S. Hey, we've got some football this weekend. Are you ready to make some picks? I know USC is not playing, BYU is not playing this weekend, but we've got some games, and so I'm going to ask you your take. So far, I think you're batting 1,000 so far.
I haven't missed any.
Yeah,
I haven't missed any. I'll give it to you real quick. Tell me the names. I'll immediately tell you who wins.
Okay, first game we've got Notre Dame, Duke.
Notre Dame.
Okay. Next game, Georgia Tech, Florida State.
Florida State.
All right. Clemson, Wake Forest.
Clemson.
And then the last one, and I only chose this one because it's got one of my favorite mascots, Coastal Carolina versus Kansas.
Beep, 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 beep. We have upset alert. Upset alert, Spencer.
Okay.
Oh, Coastal Carolina.
Coastal Carolina. Okay, now what's upset. Their mascot?
Coastal Carolina is the Eagles.
No, the Chanticleers.
Chanticleers, is that with a Q?
You know, with a C.
Okay.
That's one of my favorites. But yeah, you're picking the upset over the Mad Hatter in Dallas Miles. Huh?
Big time. Okay. Upset. That's upset written all over it.
I think you're going to go 3-1 this weekend, okay. But we'll see.
All right. Never question.
I'm picking Kansas in that one.
Okay. Never question Aaron Price's predictions, because they're 1,000. Like you said.
You are batting 1,000.
And you know that red 100, you ever see that on like testing? I imagine a red 1,000, and that's what I'm putting on.
That's okay. That's AP. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see how the weekend turns out for everybody, for you, AP, specifically, and for everybody else. You know, for everybody in the Northwest and in California and anyone's affected by these fires, we hope that you're staying safe. Stay indoors. Don't go outside if you don't have to. Anything else, AP, you want to say to anybody?
I mean, this thing's going to pass. Give it about a week or so. I'm hoping we get some better, colder weather. Monday, Tuesday, some sprinkles. By Wednesday, Thursday, we're going to have a smoke-free valley. We're going to be behind this. There's going to be a lot of pain and suffering from some people that have lost a lot. But we're going to get through this. We're going to be stronger. We're going to deal with fire, coronavirus, and a lot of other things in our society that we're dealing with. But we're going to get through it because we're strong like bulls, Spencer.
That's right. That's right. USA. Yeah. All right. Have a great weekend, everybody.
See ya.